welcome to another emergency episode of Radio Warner. These do seem to happen more often as the years go by in our podcast history. This will be episode 571, and the date today is January 4th, New Year, 2026. I am your recovering co-host, Mark Ames, in Western New York. You are listening to Radio Warner. Subscribe and support the show. Go to patreon.com/Radio Warnered and subscribe and support the show, please. Thank you. All right. I am on the line with the Warnered, back in black, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher in Italy. And John, how you doing?
I'm good. I mean, it's kind of the black days in Italy when you don't have a car. So it's okay, but you know, it's hard to focus on what's happening locally when all the dark powers seem to be rising and flexing their wings and thinking in the name of their top boss, like, I gotta kill somebody before my term runs out. I gotta do something. So he's doing as much as he can.
Yeah,
his little minions are just eager to help.
I mean, you know, predictions are always a tough thing, but I do think one thing we predicted right at the beginning of it, as Trump was coming in for his second term, was that this is going to be a very different Trump, a very active, angry, and vengeful Trump looking to take care of a lot of business. That was one thing we definitely got right. And I think it's just because we kind of understood it in our guts. Yeah. I think you had to have understood both kind of the sensibility of the right, but and also the way all of the right's grievances, which have a real basis, you know, like starting with the Russiagate, you know, and then other grievances, like how much they have fueled and trying to, you know, use lawfare to destroy Trump and failing. This is the worst thing, man. Yeah. It's like, I'm going to go into this dragon's lair. I'm going to fight it for a while, and then I'm going to give up and walk away and figure everything's going to be all right.
Yeah, I won't even look back. I'm not indifferent. Yeah.
It's like Dr. Evil when he, you know, closes the thing. You know, what? I'm just going to assume everything went right. What? Except it's the liberal, you know, it was Biden and the Dem. Oh, my God. It's just
and
so
Dr. pathetic. Evil is such a sympathetic character compared to, like, anybody at the top of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. So I, you know, my initial feeling from seeing, we of course are talking about Operation Absolute Resolve as it is cheesily called, the invasion and kidnapping, of Venezuela, and the kidnapping of their president and, first lady, and bringing them back to America and leaving the place a bit of a mess. And we'll get into that. But my initial reaction was a feeling I really had when Bush Sr. invaded Panama. And I was just remembering now, I'd kind of forgotten, I was telling a friend this, that I remember that invasion, because I'd kind of deliberately walled off having been a kind of, you know, again, we've talked about this many times, you know, a young reactionary, young Reagan supporter, had already been well disillusioned, but you just wall off a lot of things that Reagan did. You don't want to think about them.
Yeah.
But I hadn't gone over to actual anger, I think. That operation, that invasion of Panama, I think really the first time in my conscious time when I felt nothing but absolute fucking rage against my country. Like,
it was such a sleazy mafia-style operation. Like, we're going to get this guy, and then we're going to torture him, and, you know, play some loud music at him. Yeah, that'll do it.
And just kill a bunch of people. And I think it was the culture's reaction that was part of what really drove me crazy. There was such a smug triumphalism. And it was very different from this because, unlike Trump, Bush and Reagan had spent years propagandizing about, you know, the drug war and drugs and the and the threat to America, and so many people believed it that there was that, and the press by 1989 had fully come around from, you know, its brief Glasnost era and adversarial era in the 70s to being just completely in the pocket, not just of like the White House, but of the military in particular, and military action and the empire, and hasn't changed. And so there was just so much smug. It was like the whole country, or at least the leading figures of the country, that was like one big corporate party. I don't know. It was so gross.
I experienced that a little sooner, mm-hmm. not because I had any more insight, but because I had my face rubbed in what America really was at the worst level, because I accepted a job in Las Vegas and I could only stand it for 9 months. But that overlapped with the trial of Ollie North. And the reaction of the American public was astonishing and really gross. Like, mm-hmm. I remember the way The Simpsons described it, with the homoerotic undercurrent and the ridiculous patriotism. Homer is thinking of that episode and he says, "Oh, Ollie North was just poured into that uniform." And that was the main reaction. Like that Rob Reiner movie, A Few Good Men.
Yes, I was thinking that too. That's the model for him. And that's why people say, oh, he meant Jack Nicholson to be the bad guy. And I know to good liberals, and maybe even in Rob Reiner's brain, he was. But believe me, a lot of the culture saw the Jack Nicholson character as Ollie North and as the hero, and they all wanted to say that line to somebody else's face: you can't handle the truth.
Yeah. It was a terrible time, but then there were terrible times to spare, for that decade.
Yes. Yeah. So, the real brief overview, of course, we're getting word right now, or getting some, details leaked to the New York Times and the Washington Post, and the whole story is being well massaged about this perfectly executed special forces operation that nobody else in the world can do except us. So we're, as the saying from the triumphalist pro-militarist types would say, this is what the Venezuelans found out why Americans don't have health care again. And it's so that Trump and some other sleazy billionaires can play empire games and steal oil. And isn't that wonderful? Doesn't that make us all better and tough? Yeah. So I don't, I've gone through, and I have here in my notes some of the military details. I don't give a shit. I don't know about the military details. And, they had a B-1 bomber suppressing radar, and the Venezuelans had 6 different radar systems and they were all suppressed, and 5,000 man pads and none of them were used. I think it's becoming pretty clear that this was a prearranged kidnapping, and the question
and an
is who arranged.
Job with
that's what
plenty,
I mean. Yeah,
plenty of cooperation.
Exactly. I mean, we have been told that the CIA had an asset in Maduro's inner circle, and that is why we got to know Maduro and his wife's every single move. We also know that Maduro was negotiating with the Trump regime on possibly some kind of deal, some kind of extradition deal, some kind of he would leave the country deal. And at some point, as Trump said, he waited too long, it's too late. And so I think really the two main questions are, was it Maduro himself? Was this a whole stage thing, kind of like the Osama bin Laden raid that was supposedly this great daring raid, and it just turned out the whole thing was pretty well stage managed and they just shot him and his wife in bed. Was this a completely stage managed operation to give Trump, the necessary theatrics that he needs, like that there was this great operation that went on? Or was he just sold out by people in the inner circle? Or was he sold out by people in the inner circle and he knew it? And so that also made things go pretty smoothly. This was not like a complete surprise operation. There's no way, because nobody fought them.
And you know, you and I have both seen that excellent RTE documentary about an earlier coup attempt against Chavez, and in I think 2002 and
2002.
What April. Is clear is mm-hmm. that there are a lot of people in the Venezuelan elite who are up for grabs,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to go with whatever looks to be the winning side, and it's not hard to imagine mm-hmm. that many of those were up for purchase or rent, at least.
Yeah. And there is also, as Radio Warner guest Miguel Tinker-Salas mentioned in our interview with him last month, there is also a Chavismo bourgeoisie that really came to, I think, even more so under Maduro. Mm-hmm. And I think the whole, you know, sanctions on the level that the U.S. imposed on a country that is basically a resource-driven oil. I mean, it has the largest oil reserves in the world. Venezuela does. You know, when you impose sanctions, you kind of reorder the economy, and it's a good way of creating a new, more corrupt bourgeoisie, which then is more pliable. Right. You want a more pliable bourgeoisie like that. And then, of course, the so-called sort of white, you know, upper middle class, upper class, they, of course, have been begging for the U.S. to come in for years now. So there are a lot of turncoats, and the economy has obviously suffered a lot under really grueling sanctions, the sanctions regime. Sanctions are such a bland, neutral-sounding word, but it's economic warfare, and it's real, and it kills people, a lot of people. So you know, I think we're going to have to wait probably to find out exactly what really happened with this operation. In the meantime, we're getting a nice massaged version and a lot of triumphalism again, a lot of it.
Yes.
How great our military is and unsurpassed in the world and all this.
Which is really absurd. I mean, this is, as I was implying, a very corrupt country. People are easily bought and they can change sides very quickly, just as the bodyguard unit changed sides in mid-coup when they decided that the Chavistas were likely to win. And above all, it's a very simple operation, snatch and grab and leave, for a highly trained paramilitary group like Delta Force. I mean, once you get them off coke for a few hours, they're probably pretty good. And this would have been a much easier mission. Go in there, grab the couple, and take them out. Especially when you realize this was kind of like an operation that learned from past mistakes. Like when Lenin and company decided to that, you know, the Tsar and his family just had to go. They were building on a lot of experience. Like, if you leave a king and his family alive, there are going to be problems. And that was very clear after the 2002 attempted coup and eventual restoration of Chavez, because they had to take him back and they were humiliated. And whoever was minding the operation in the CIA probably knew that very well, and they decided, no, we've got to get them. Got to get both of them, the couple, and take them with us. because, you know, the Tsar, the Bolsheviks just decided, just kill them. Just kill the whole family. It's a lot simpler. And even then, there were tons of stories for generations after that of Anastasia, the surviving daughter. There's still people filing claims, I think, in whatever court claims jurisdiction, that they are the daughters or granddaughters of Anastasia. So what you want is to eliminate whatever passes for the royal line. And obviously, Maduro, Chavez, they aren't royalty, but they fill that function, as was clear when people realized that Chavez was alive.
Yeah.
So the next best thing is to put him in a supermax in the U.S. Mm-hmm. They're not getting out of there.
Yeah, that was the lesson with Noriega. I mean, Noriega was never a social reformer. I mean, no. It's funny to even say that. He wasn't a social reformer like Chavez and Chavismo. You know, he was the CIA's guy. He was Bush's guy who went rogue, and so he had to be taken out. That's all that happened. So, you know, but people genuinely did love, a lot of people did, really liked Chavez. Poverty rates really did plummet under Chavez. And so the strategy, and they always, you know, on some really malevolent things, the U.S. does have a long memory and a long game. And what they did to, there was a long game to crush Chavismo, which is leftist and socialist and can't be allowed, particularly with all that oil. And that was to eventually use a combination of weapons, lawfare being a big one. So you have to, you want to extract him, as you said, Maduro, the head, but you need to prepare proper vilifying case against him. And so he's a human rights abuser, he's a torturer, he's anti-democratic.
He's fentanyl dealer.
He's a fentanyl dealer.
It's bizarre.
I know. But you attach him to one of the worst problems in America. You just attach him to it, and who cares? Yeah. You stitch it up. It's like any DA does that.
Can I just say
that
as an ex-druggie, not exactly proud, but not ashamed either, I will say...
ex-druggie and ex-right-winger.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. A few people did that at the same time. Well, who are willing to admit it. I never, never believed, and I don't think there was any sane druggie who ever believed, that the source of the drugs could be amputated or cauterized, and then the drugs would stop and demand for them would stop, and everybody would dance around rainbows in the United States. The demand starts the process.
Yeah,
you know that there are these things and you want them. It's pretty simple. So I don't think anybody past the age of 12 really believes that you cut off demand and the problem goes away.
Yeah, the indictment accuses him of, well, I think now they're saying shipping cocaine. I mean, there is, I think what could be said is some cocaine from Latin America, particularly from Trump's ally in Ecuador, is some of it shipped maybe through a port in Venezuela on its way north. Like, I think it's the most you could say, but Venezuela is not a cocaine producer either. There's no real evidence. I mean, even media that wants to support any imperial activity, like the New York Times, you know, even they point out that two of the alleged cartel groups named by the Trump administration, one of them simply doesn't exist. And another one, I think, as Max Blumenthal has pointed out, was literally created by the CIA and the DEA in the early 90s with Venezuela in order to track. They use Venezuelan military people in order to try to track and entrap Colombian cocaine kingpins. And so it was just, it was a CIA invention, and they actually shipped a lot of, it's like Deep Cover, but for reals, you know, they shipped a lot of, there was a lot of that going on, shipped a lot of cocaine into the U.S. supposedly to track the cocaine, and it got busted open on 60 Minutes. And so anyway, that all is bullshit, but because you have a whole legal infrastructure with the war on drugs and with the war on terror, the Trump people have just kind of combined the two, you know, and used the designation narco-terrorist for Maduro as the justification for kidnapping him and hauling him off to prison in the U.S.
And the strange thing is that I used to think either people were ignorant about this story, the drug story, really, or they were just complicit. And I think now it's a much more sophisticated mix of the two.
Yes, yes.
Than I ever realized.
Yeah.
And the latest revelation in that regard is that the New York Times and Washington Post had advanced knowledge of the invasion and kept it secret. That's, to me, that's shocking.
Yeah.
I still believe in some things, like at least people want to be famous, you know, if they're journalists, and at least they want to put out a story that will blow the headlines wide open. But no, they have this perfect discipline, or their editors have
They're editors, and
they're not going to do it.
Nope, they want the access. They don't want to be blamed. I think what terrifies, because everybody just wants to hold on to their jobs in elite culture. That's it. And what terrifies them, unlike in earlier eras, is having the public hate them or the public thinking, you know, you're against us or something. They're really terrified of that now in a way that they weren't when I was very young. But it's a kind of, I don't know, it's a pretty deeply held. They want to be loved as guardians of democracy and truth without actually doing anything to guard democracy.
Yeah.
They just don't want to get in trouble. But yeah, the funny thing about the New York Times and Washington Post having advance warning and, of course, holding on to that, is that the first headlines, and it was up for a long time after everybody and their goddamn dog knew that the U.S. invaded. Nevertheless, the New York Times headline, in order to be super, you know, safe and following the rules of objective journalism, their headline was, Venezuela accuses U.S. of carrying out attacks on Capitol, when they knew in advance the U.S. was carrying out those attacks. But they wanted to make sure, we don't know if it's true or not. You know, you can't really trust Venezuela. They accused the U.S. They knew it. They just knew it. I mean, so I guess at least you could say, unlike in 2002, this time around, the first in-house editorial by the New York Times opposed the invasion and kidnapping, whereas the Washington Post, can I just read a tiny bit here?
Sure.
Their editorial, Justice in Venezuela, is the headline of Jeff Bezos, of the media outlet purchased by the second richest oligarch in the world. Many ways a lot more powerful, not as rich, I guess, on paper, but a lot more powerful, I would say. Smarter than Elon Musk, the
saner,
number one.
Yeah.
Saner, yeah, colder. Like, I mean, this guy moves everything around the world. You know, he doesn't sell cars. He moves shit all around the world. And it has a very deep ties with the CIA and so on. Anyway, the headline is Justice in Venezuela. Millions of people around the world, most of all in Venezuela, are celebrating the downfall of the dictator Nicolas Maduro. First of all, nobody in Venezuela is celebrating it. That's the whole joke. In fact, pro-Trump, there's so much bot action on X. I mean, speaking of what Musk can do on X Twitter, just like if you post something against the invasion, you'll get all of these weird accounts that you've never seen before going into your feed saying, this is different, this is great, what do you support? It's all the same shit you get with every war, except it's conservative bots rather than liberal bots. Anyway, President Donald Trump's decision to capture him on Saturday was one of the boldest moves a president has made in years. and the operation was an unquestionable tactical success. The next step is ensuring that this triumph sets Venezuela up for stability and prosperity. Notice how they don't say, as the WAPO normally would, democracy. They don't even bother saying that. Rather than more of the same or worse, what happened in Caracas was a clear reminder that America's military, intelligence, and cyber capabilities are second to none. Hurrah! All right, yeah. So this is like the elites of this country. This is how they
I mean, they were really massaging Trump's message, which must have made a lot of people in the press office go pale. it's like, we're going to run the oil business for them. That really caused a lot of people to start sweating, I think. You're not supposed to say that.
Yep. I just for comparison here, this was 2002 in the New York Times, April 13th, when Chavez was violently overthrown in a coup with combined forces of the head of of Venezuela's Chamber of Commerce was made interim president. He had military backing, and the CIA was balls deep in it. And it was violent, too. They clearly orchestrated false flag shootings in order to kind of front for the coup. Here's how the New York Times opined on it. This is the editorial, the newspaper, the editorial we. The headline is, Hugo Chavez departs.
Or was departed.
Yes. With yesterday's resignation of President Hugo Chavez, Venezuelan democracy is no longer threatened by a would-be dictator. Mr. Chavez, a ruinous demagogue, stepped down. I mean, this is a guy who won overwhelming majority. Stepped down after the military intervened and handed power to a respected business leader, Pedro Camacho. Yada, yada, yada. So, this is all par for the course stuff. But one thing I thought was particularly sinister, like really sinister, because, Zoran Mamdani just was inaugurated as mayor of New York City. Right. And I didn't see the whole speech, but I saw parts of it. I have to say, it was not a speech you ever get from any Democratic liberal politician. It was had a lot more depth to it and somewhat more radical. And one of the most radical things he said, which really shocked a lot of kind of the elites, the rich in this country, including my old partner, Matt Taibbi, who denounced it. He said something like, we're going to replace the coldness of rugged individualism with the warmth of collectivism. It was but he said it in a much more beautiful way.
Right.
And it's a beautiful thought, So here's what the deputy opinion editor, this is like the new Fred Hyatt, or the sort of spawning Fred Hyatt of the Washington Post, wrote in order to promote their editorial supporting the kidnapping coup, whatever. His name is James Homan, and he says, he tweeted, Washington Post editorial, : for years, Maduro was a symbol of the false warmth of Latin American collectivism. Now he should spend the rest of his life alone in a humane American prison. His downfall is good news. This is it.
Humane. We'll make it so humane. Yeah. But we'll even slip his oatmeal in a little tray with no human contact.
By saying he's a symbol of the false warmth of Latin American collectivism and he should be in a prison, this is a direct shot at Mamdani. I mean, direct, because this is all people were talking about was how he mentioned the warmth of collectivism. This is mafia shit.
Probably not sell Mamdani life insurance for few years.
The sheer number of lone nuts that are being wound up right now. It's pretty scary. So continuing on, let's talk about some reactions here. Some interesting reactions. Kaya Kallas, I think a lot of people saw this. Kaya Kallas, we've talked about a lot on this show. She is the endlessly pontificating, basically you call it foreign minister of the EU, and who is always pontificating about rules-based order, international law, countries can't invade other countries, you know, talking about Russia, of course. Here she is after the U.S. just blatantly and is bragging about it, violated international law and invaded and kidnapped a state leader. I have spoken with Secretary of, this is Kallas. I've spoken with Secretary of State Marco Rubio and our ambassador in Caracas. The EU is closely monitoring the situation in Venezuela. Can you feel the outrage here, the moral outrage? The EU has repeatedly stated that Mr. Maduro lacks legitimacy and has defended a peaceful transition. You know, we call for restraint. And there's just, it's support. It's support. Yeah. It is rolling over it's, support.
It's like, be careful, but go ahead.
Yeah. Ukraine's foreign minister, Andrei Sybiha, Ukraine has basically supported it. Ukraine has consistently defended the right of nations to live freely, free of dictatorship, oppression, and human rights violations. The Maduro regime has violated all such principles in every respect. So you have Ukraine supporting the concept of a large, bullying, powerful foreign neighbor just going in and taking out a leader of a country it doesn't like. Based on what and violating international law.
I have to say, I thought people had a bit of a cringe with armed intervention by the United States forces in Central America or Northern South America. It surprises me that there's no memory of that, no apparent guilt about that, because it's a dirty history.
Yes, and I have to say, European leaders, pre end of the Cold War, they weren't like rebels, right? But they did stand up at various times. They stood up and criticized openly and refused to condone the Vietnam War, or Reagan's dirty wars, or what he was doing with the Contras, or the invasion of Grenada. I think even Thatcher, you know, came out and denounced it. Like, there was some sense that they must show sovereignty, some independence, some sovereignty, and denounce, you know, some acts that were violations of international law. And there's just none of it now. By the people who are the most sanctimonious supporters and advocates of it. Yeah, it's shocking.
I mean, Macron issued this truly disgusting statement.
Yes.
France is fully mobilized and vigilant, including to ensure the safety of its nationals. The Venezuelan people are today rid of Maduro's dictatorship and can only rejoice. I don't think they rejoice about that. But Starmer said roughly the same thing. And what you're seeing here, and I keep stressing this because I don't think people realize it enough, or either that or they're complicit in it, is a scared reaction by the elite that funds the media and everything else. And ever since at least the Gaza war, because that wasn't supposed to happen, that massive collective revulsion about the Gaza massacres changed things, and they're not happy with it.
Yeah, and in fact, speaking of Starmer, Brendan, can you play a clip of Starmer being confronted on his own? Starmer, you got to remember, his whole thing is that he is he claimed to be basically like a human rights and rules. I mean, he's has a legal background, and he's supposed to be the guy upholding international law, Western civil, you know, Western law, Western legal traditions. That's his thing. So this is Starmer being grilled a little bit by a BBC presenter who's very, very much like the pro-Starmer type, very in favor of like all the NATO and, you know, Atlanticism and rules-based international order and, you know, the Ukraine war cause and so on.
And you've been incredibly clear always that Vladimir Putin's attack on a sovereign country of Ukraine was wrong and ought to be condemned. What about President Trump's attack on a sovereign country of Venezuela? There are all sorts of horrors that we know about President Maduro's government. But for America to strike that country and then capture its leader, that's an action against a sovereign state that surely flies in the face of international law.
Well, at the moment, it's a fast-moving situation.
We know those facts. President Trump, the White House has said that they captured Maduro and they struck his country. So there's a lot we don't know, but we do know that. So will you condemn that action against the sovereign state?
Well, I want to get all the material facts together, and we simply haven't got the full picture at the moment. It's fast-moving. And we need to piece that together. I can be really clear with you that there was no UK involvement in this operation. And obviously we're working in relation to British citizens and nationals who are there with our embassy. But we need to establish the full picture. I then need to speak to President Trump. I need to speak to our allies. But I don't shy away from this. I've been a lifelong advocate of international law and the importance of compliance with international law. But I want to ensure that I've got all the facts at my disposal, and we haven't got that at the moment, and we need to get that before
we take a couple of years to get that
come
facts.
To a decision about the consequences in relation to the actions that have been taken.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously they did not wait for all the facts to come in to, you know, to condemn Putin, and it's a joke.
It's almost literally a joke, like, I don't know who it is, but there's somebody in Monty Python that he really resembles vocally.
Yeah. On the other hand, and this I think is kind of interesting, and this is why this movement is gaining force, Marine Le Pen, ahead of the fascist or post-fascist National Front, or now it's the National Rally. Here's what she posted. And I think the guy who's the little minion who's in charge of the party posted something similar. But she posted, there were 1,000 reasons to condemn the regime of Nicolas Maduro. Communistic, oligarchic, and authoritarian, it had imposed on its people for far too many years a suffocating yada, yada, yada. But there is one fundamental reason to oppose the regime change that the United States has just brought about in Venezuela. The sovereignty of states is never negotiable, regardless of their size, their power, or their continent. It is inviolable. Am I saying that right? And sacred.
Inviolable.
Inviolable, yeah. And sacred. To renounce this principle today for Venezuela, for any state, would be to accept our own enslavement tomorrow. And it goes on. I mean, that's the kind of statement you would expect from a leader that cares about their sovereignty at all. And that's the thing. The far right, or some of the far right parties, are able to claim that ground that used to be a lot more, that was not such a controversial ground to claim until the last 20, 30 years. But now it's like, this is how you get far right parties taking power, is you see that ground to them.
And I think it also follows on centrist parties, as they say, circling the wagons and being afraid of what used to be centrist opinion, because it has turned in many ways against them. Whereas the right, there's always been that stroppy, uppity strain among right-wing opinion makers, and it's tolerated in that crowd.
Here's Mark Carney, who actually got himself elected by grandstanding against Trump, and then as soon, and this is what Dan Bickner, who, when we had him on, when we talked about Canada, is exactly what he predicted. And I remember it actually upset a lot of people, even in comments. He said that the minute he took power, he was just going to completely roll over, which he has. And he's, and he, I mean, I don't, you know, it's the people who rise to the top in this centrist world have a way of just boring you to death. And then you have to remember they said nothing and it's not a condemnation. He said, one of the first actions taken by Canada's new government, my government, was to impose additional sanctions on Nicolas Maduro's brutally. So he's saying, hey, I was helping. And then it just goes on from there. Canada hasn't recognized the illegitimate regime of Maduro since it stole the 2018 election. He didn't actually steal that one. I think it's very well argued that there was massive fraud in the 2024 election, but 2018 was not stolen. They just decided it was, and so on. So, you know, Canada supports it, which is funny because Trump is threatening to invade Canada, right? I think he offered to make Carney like a governor or something. So maybe Carney's just kind of auditioning for his future. I would suppose that's not going to happen, but Greenland I would take more seriously because it's undefended. Trump likes to blow shit up when people can't fight back, and Greenland would not be able to fight back.
There's a strange, Martian time slip, as it were, in a lot of what Trump says. And I never thought he could get away with it to the extent that he does. Like, we'll just annex Greenland. And there was some timid giggles from the in crowd in Washington. But he said, we're going to take over the oil of this country we have just invaded. And I don't see a lot of outrage in the domestic opinion on that.
Yeah, in fact, it's even worse, I think, in a sense, because, yeah, he's saying, I mean, he's not, this is part of the whole MAGA mask off, tell it like it really is, politics, which is we're not pretending that we're there to restore democracy and human rights and all that stuff. That because MAGA world doesn't trust that for partially legitimate reasons. None of us trust it, right? But they, because it was always a front for imperialism anyway. But they think if you take the mask off and tell it like it is, that there's something cathartic or something better about it. There isn't anything better about it. It just is what it is. I'm not sure, but I think there's also a political reason for this that people miss. I mean, you know, you would say what we're so used to is, okay, you do this decapitation job, but you already have your America, your some center right or center left president, and you already have so-called civil society. You already have kind of a people infrastructure ready to take power. And you've trained them up in your various USAID and National Endowment for Democracy programs. And you've got to know them through all the conferences and all the revolving door stuff that goes on with these programs when you basically create a comprador class that can take power after color revolutions. And Trump, of course, dismantled all of that. And a big reason why he dismantled all of that in the beginning of the year is because he and the right saw that the same people who run those programs and who are nurtured in those programs and who fund those programs and are on the boards of directors of those programs are the same people that fought him tooth and nail in 2017 through 2021 that said he was an illegitimate president, that MAGA is Russia controlled or something else. They're his enemies. So that they would think if we get another one of these USAID basically nurtured, milk-fed, like Maria Corina Machado, that eventually she's going to be another Kaya Kallas or another one of these people who believe in that world that is really the domestic enemy for Trump, domestic and the political enemy of MAGA and Trump world. So instead what Trump is doing, and this is why, you know, I think early on in the show, we've talked about how this was an inside job. This invasion / kidnapping operation was an inside job. So what they've done is they've left the vice president in power. And this is Delcy Rodriguez. She is the vice president. She has just now been appointed president since Maduro is out. And Trump has kind of made it pretty clear that this is who they're going to do business with, at least for now. And that raises all kinds of questions. But the first thing I want to do is just play a little clip of Trump dismissing Maria Corina Machado, who is, of course, the toast of the Western world. She won the Nobel Peace Prize despite having, you know, worked her whole life in these USAID NED programs to try to bring down first Hugo Chavez and then Maduro. And she has been calling for and begging for an invasion by the U.S. for years now. And on top of it, she claims that Maduro played a key role in stealing Trump's election in 2020 and handing it to Biden. This is a Nobel Peace Prize winner. And she did that to win over Trump. But here, Brendan, can you play how Trump dismissed Maria Corina Machado?
Are you aware of the location of opposition leader Machado, and have you been in contact with her?
No, we haven't.
Mr. President,
do you have any hesitations about Machado?
Mr. President, on Monday...
Oh, I think it would be very tough for her to be the leader. She doesn't have the support within... or the respect within the country. She's a very nice woman, but she doesn't have the respect to be the leader.
Is it possible?
Okay, so that's Trump dismissing her. And I think, as I understand, he's getting his assessment of Corina Machado comes from Marco Rubio. And you got to understand, right. We've talked about this before. Marco Rubio is a very powerful figure. He's kind of like, you know, like how Pompeo was in the first Trump administration. He is... You know, not since Henry Kissinger, I believe, has there been somebody who's been both Secretary of State and the head of the National Security Council. He's extremely powerful. My guess is Trump sees him as somebody who is just very effective.
Right. And he would probably see Machado, no matter how much she tries to tilt to the right, as someone soft.
Yeah.
And probably that international award is proof of how soft she is.
Yes. Yeah. And, you know, she spent time, they've met her. I was watching Max Blumenthal talk about this. You know, she's been in D.C. They have met her. They have vetted her. And they have tried to get her to explain how she would gain control in a chaotic environment of the military, of this apparatus. And they just spoke, I think really, I mean, if I were to sort of interpret, Machado and her team spoke in these kind of cliches that you get at USAID conferences. Like they didn't really know what the fuck they were talking about, basically.
Right.
In Rubio's version and Trump's version. So what Trump has basically said is that they're going to rule, the U.S. is going to rule with a gun pointed at the head of Delcy Rodriguez and say, see what happened to Maduro. If you don't want that to happen, you need to listen to us on the big picture items here. You've got to open up the oil because Chavez, socialized it. He nationalized the massive oil industry, the largest in the world, reserves in the world. And that's really when the Bush administration first put a bead on Chavez. And if you don't, then you're next. I mean, it seems pretty clear that's what the deal is.
Yeah, but in that context, what's interesting to me anyway is her, Delcy's quite pointed response to getting nominated for next in line. It was like, oh, no, don't put that on me. I'm not, no, we want Maduro. Yay.
Yeah. And she's saying, you know, Maduro's still the legitimate president. She's saying, she's talking a talk that doesn't make it sound like she was, you know, part of a palace coup with the U.S., that she's talking independence talk, but we'll see what she actually does. Who knows?
Yeah.
We don't know actually what she will do. We really don't. But the Trump
she might be totally
confident.
Sincere, or she might just be, well, given the terrible situation of the country besieged and all, I guess I got to do it. I got to take the reins.
I got to bend. Yeah. Mm. She was, I think, the petroleum minister. She was a communications minister. I mean, I think she is considered, when she was vice president, so she is considered a lot more of a serious person than, for example, Maria Corina Machado, somebody who can actually, you know, carry out orders or make things happen. A brief background on her, it's kind of interesting. Her father was the founder of a Marxist guerrilla group in the 70s. You know, Venezuela was not... Venezuela had a pretty big Marxist left-wing, sort of left nationalist guerrilla, urban guerrilla groups that operated, and I think some in rural areas, in the 60s and 70s. And her father was arrested for... There was an American business executive for a glass company who was kidnapped in 1976, and they wanted money, and they wanted that company to publish, like take out ads in a few papers and a few world capitals saying, you know, we've been exploiting Venezuela, we've been bribing officials, and we apologize. And then they would have let him go. But when, so the company tried to work with the Venezuelan regime, a very pro-Western regime, and the regime said, no, absolutely do not give in to them. The company wanted their executive home, so they published the ads. And at that point, the Venezuelan regime just cut ties with the company. So this guy was held in a jungle, hostage for 3.5 years. I actually read his obituary not too long ago. He was held, and he was found just kind of in a random patrol. He was being watched by two guards. They always covered their faces. And according to this guy who was released and sent back, you know, allowed to go home, so he was in captivity for 3 years, he said the guards always treated him well. They promised him they would never hurt him or kill him or anything, and they held to their promise. And he said when the Venezuelans captured him, the guards were just like right there. They captured him, the guards gave up, and the police just shot them execution style anyway, and he was kind of traumatized by that. But anyway, her dad, Delcy Rodriguez, was arrested in 76, I believe it was, for that kidnapping and tortured to death. Wow. And so that's kind of, you know, her background. Real quickly, Brendan, can you play the clip of a Florida Republican, Diaz-Balart, freaking out? And this happened all day yesterday. There's a whole, like, a Venezuelan diaspora community which, you know, worships and is invested, deeply invested in, you know, in Maria Corina Machado becoming the president, becoming the leader. Or maybe this guy Edmundo Gonzalez, who was the guy who actually ran in the election in 2024. But, man, this guy is so old, he makes... There's some talk of maybe trying to install him, but I just saw a clip of him being helped as he walked, and he makes Biden look like Usain Bolt or something. Like, he is so feeble. So anyway, play this clip of a press conference. He's not in a good mood, this Representative Diaz-Balart. He's a representative in an area that is big. He's Cuban-American himself and is big with the Cuban and Venezuelan diaspora. You know, and we all know what the Cuban diaspora is like and the Venezuelan diaspora. So can you play this real quickly?
Why are you not willing to support Maria Corina and Edmundo to be...
Oh, whoa, 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 wait, 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 wait. Hold on. Hold on, sir.
Let's talk about that.
First, yeah. You're talking to us?
Yes.
When have we ever not supported
her?
Wait. But let's... Look, these are serious issues. Yes. Do not put words in my mouth.
Well,
and do not... No, wait. But you said us.
Yes.
You said us.
Yeah.
You said us. Okay. It's very... I will not tolerate putting words in my mouth or my colleague's mouth.
Yeah.
We have been consistent from day one. And I am convinced there's going to be a transition. We already talked about that. And I'm convinced that when there are elections, whether there are new elections or there's a decision to take the old elections, the last elections, that the next democratically elected president of Venezuela is going to be Maria Corina Machado.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, narrator. No, it's not. I mean,
sounded a little like a threat. In fact, like, you know, you don't do this to me.
Yes, I think that's exactly what's happening. But what's he going to do? So he's taking it out on a reporter at Fox, at least this was on Fox News, taking out a reporter because what is he going to scream at Trump? No, he's not going to scream at Trump. But I guarantee you, and these are powerful people who donate a lot of money, they are freaking out at the way Trump is doing this. But Trump's people, first of all, do not want to do a regime change like the way that the liberals, the Bidens, the Obamas, the Bush, whatever, like the other regime changes. They want things done without, as they would say, you know, in the mask off way. Mm-hmm. We are not doing this for democracy. We are not doing this for the Nobel Peace Prize Committee. We're doing this to take the oil. And so we are going to run this crudely. We don't give a fuck about the Venezuelan people. That's he's going to find he's got problems with that because there's a secondary. Yes. I mean, there are a lot of problems. Yeah, because you do want to actually, in theory,
I saw a clip of a Cuban American or was it Venezuelan American? I'm not sure. Audience just cheering for all of Trump's points until he got to the oil. And then they were not happy.
No. It reminds me a little bit of when in Operation Barbarossa, when the Nazis invaded Galicia, the Lvov area, with battalions of Ukrainian fascists, Banderas people. And the fascists were like, yeah, we're all doing this together. And they are killing Jews together and having a gay old time. And then the Ukrainians like, okay, we're setting up our state now. And the Nazis are like, no, you're not setting up your state. This isn't about you. This is about the Nazis. You know, you're gone. And they put Bandera in a kind of in a club-fed sort of prison in Germany for a while. This is not about that community. This is about Trump and the oil and the gold and the lithium. And bauxite, I believe. I mean, there's an enormous... Those two countries, Venezuela and Guyana, I saw a statement or whatever, a quote from Oleg Deripaska, the Russian oligarch who hates me, is what I've written about him. But anyway, he said that this is a threat, that the U.S. now... Because Guyana was the largest find in I don't know how many decades. Guyana, and they gave all the concessions to Exxon... But it's better than your usual banana republic concession, as far as I know. I mean, Guyana is actually finally, after all the hell it's been through thanks to the U.S., it's actually getting kind of wealthier. It's a small country, so it's a little easier to trickle down. And there were disputes between Venezuela and Guyana about who gets what oil fields. But if the U.S. controls, which is going to happen, and it's almost for sure to some degree— You know, those two countries' oil reserves, that's an enormous amount of power over oil markets. Enormous amount of power.
Right. It's as if somebody is now playing Risk. As if they are pubescent boys playing Risk. And they don't realize that it wasn't compassion or decency that prevented the senior officials of the former U.S. from going full Risk player and seizing somebody else's armies or cards. But I think they're going to realize this, that it doesn't really pay in the long run.
Yeah. So, you know, apparently we're going to be running things there now. And, you know, Trump, of course, had come in saying that...
And he's doing this thing like, no boots on the ground, don't worry about that. How do you run things? How do you run an oil industry?
Well, he did he did correct me. He said, I'm not afraid of putting boots on the ground. You might have to do that. Yeah.
Well, as long as he's not afraid.
I know. It's just, and you know, you're seeing, it's funny. You're seeing the old crew coming back together, which is the MAGA, the Trump part of the Republican Party, almost all of it. There are a few holdouts like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Tucker Carlson maybe, but even like Nick Fuentes. Like they're all rallying around this because this is manly. It's taking what's ours. It's controlling our hemisphere. And they're back together with the old Iraq War crew. David Frum, Jonah Goldberg. I had a tweet, a whole bunch of these idiots, John Podhoretz. It's like all the old Cretans from the beginning of the century that we all used to write about. They're all back praising this. They're all into it. And then, you know, as with happened with the Iraq War, a portion of the center, like centrists, are also behind this with a few caveats. My old friend, this is really sweet to see, my old friend Michael McFaul went back to being wishy-washy. You know, normally this guy is just constantly like burning the candle at both ends to display his moral outrage at violations of international law and human rights. And then America does an invasion, and here he is. I don't agree with how Maduro was removed from power. Ooh, that's going to hurt. But now that he has been removed, hoping for a smooth transition to democratic restoration in Venezuela.
God.
I know.
What is that commercial it reminds me of? I don't shave every day, but when I do.
Yeah. Here's one of many. Some people were posting McFaul tweets about Russia's invasion. Here's one. He says, because he was a very big on a total blockade of Russia and Russians and ethnic Russians and so on. And he tweeted out March 2nd about Russians' responsibility and how they should react when there's been when their country violates international law. There are no more, quote, innocent, quote, neutral Russians anymore. Everyone has to make a choice, support or oppose this war. The only way to end this war is if hundreds of thousands, not thousands, protest against this senseless war. Putin can't arrest you all. Sure, a lot of you are going to die and get arrested and your lives will be, but not all hundreds of thousands of you that will, I mean, yeah. And then with him, in case his endless striving for power is possibly road bumped. I don't agree with how Maduro was removed from power. Right. I mean, it's just.
Yeah, and then later, Gaza presented an opportunity for, I'm afraid, yes, a lot of Palestinian babies will have to die. Yeah. I'm not going to go into whether they're guilty or not. They just are going to have to die.
War's a bad thing. Things happen in warfare. Yeah. Did you see that Stephen Miller's wife posted a tweet of Greenland wrapped in the U.S. flag, a map of Greenland, and she says soon. She posted that right after news of the invasion.
Good God.
So this is one of the other facets here, because the Trump administration has been working on this invasion, you know, since taking power. The way it congealed was, take the oil, get rid of Maduro, which Trump wasn't able to do in his first administration. They tried very hard and they weren't able to. And also create a cause for mass deportations. If you can somehow say, I'm not sure this is working out, but the idea is either that if Maduro is no longer there, then all the Venezuelan refugees and so on have no longer cause to be in America, and then they could do a mass deportation of the many, many hundreds of thousands.
Instead of acknowledging the fact that regime change operations like this create enormous numbers of refugees.
Exactly.
But then Trump is aiming at kind of dumb audience, you know, like really dumbed down. I think when he said, I like the poorly educated, I don't conflate well-educated and intelligent, but I think that's what he meant.
It's manly. Yep. It's not wishy-washy. It's manly to not think too much. I've seen that a lot. I don't care about legality or not. I've saw this, you know, Nick Fuentes. This is good if it, if we get the oil and we use this to kick out all the Venezuelans. All other talk is bullshit. I'm a mask off guy. So, we'll see what happens.
Well, I think we have to wait for the other casualties to drop. Even in that documentary, it took a while for the Maduro loyalists to respond. They can't respond with the alacrity of an armed force.
You know, it was a part of the armed forces that were loyal, especially presidential guard, I think, that was still loyal to Maduro. And then, of course, like, all the poor people supported him, and they poured out. Will they do that for Maduro? I don't know, because, I mean, it's a really good question. Yeah, we're going to have to watch and see how this goes. Trump saying, I'm doing it for the oil, we're going to make billions and billions of dollars, is a really good way to mobilize people onto the streets in anger against you. But he's doing this, you know, as always, these are for domestic audiences. I mean, he's saying this for the domestic audience, to tweak the people that his base hates and to inspire MAGA in mask-offedness. It's hard to say. I mean, the U.S. has been beating up, like, it kind of beat up less Latin America in the last sort of 20, 30 years than it had the previous century. But America's been beating up and just really beating up. I mean, you know, I was thinking about it. All of the dirty wars we wage and so on. You know, like, we heard endlessly about how cruel and savage the Soviet occupation was of its satellites in Eastern Europe, and, you know, the crushing of the 1956 Hungarian uprising and the 1968 in Prague. But, like, it really needs to be compared to the way the U.S. crushed, not even talking about what it did overseas in Asia and elsewhere, but in Latin America, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands killed and tortured and jailed and disappeared in order to keep it from going communist. So anyway, we will obviously keep our eye on this. It looks really depressing. It looks very dangerous. Trump and his people are pushing out, by the way, who's next, right? And there's a lot of this triumphalist talk now, very much like 2003. Remember, right after the Iraq invasion, who's next? Syria, Iran. It was always North Korea. Well, North Korea detonated a bomb, so strike North Korea off the list. Who doesn't have a bomb yet? And now they're saying, you know,
it's interesting that a lot of formerly centrist left commentators are finally willing to say, hey, all you guys that might be on Trump's hate list, hurry up with the bomb. Hurry up with the nukes.
Yeah, but it's not going to happen that fast. I think it's pretty clear that Cuba is one of the overriding targets here. I mean, Trump and particularly his boy Marco Rubio and their whole Mar-a-Lago base, they have wanted, talk about long memories, they want Cuba theirs. There's almost nothing deeper than that in the south of this country than wanting to get Cuba, get rid of the communists, and make Cuba an American satellite again. And this does help because Venezuela was an important prop, really, pillar for Cuba after Cuba lost the Soviet Union. I mean, it gave Cuba their energy. So Cuba is probably next in the crosshairs, and there are other countries.
But at least we have a former Delta Force agent who's willing to talk seditiously. And we can come back to that for inspiration. This is Stan Goff, who went sort of rogue after.
I remember you reviewed his book in The Exile. Yeah. It was a great review. Yeah.
He said, come back and see the situation in 6 months. This was obviously an inside job. Delta had to have minute by minute direct intelligence. A snatch operation is in and out. It does not constitute even so much as a coup. It is certainly not controlled subsequent to the operation. Talk of running the country is not only premature, it's insane. There is still a Venezuelan government. Occupying and administering Venezuela would take a massive force. And there's no indication that this has been prepared.
I think that all sounds totally sensible, absolutely. Yeah. And I think what might happen, I mean, Trump wants like a TV win, and a spectacle, an event, and he's got it. And then after that, they might figure, well, we can have endless hard negotiations and no one's going to really follow all of that, whatever happens afterwards. And we can probably wring out of them some kind of concessions for our oil companies. I mean, I don't know, but that's a guess. Like, because if he's actually thinking of running the place and demanding, really supplicating, you know, rule from now the president, from the vice president, Delcy Rodriguez, I agree. I don't see how you have so many powerful factions and figures in that country, in the military, in the oil industry, in politics. It's not going to be easy.
No.
To run it. And
they're very well able to look after themselves. And
yeah.
That's what they do.
Yeah. Well, that's at least a slightly more cheerful note to end it on. Let's end it on that. This is our emergency episode on Trump's kidnapping of the Venezuelan president, Nicolas Maduro. Thank you, everyone. Thanks, John and Brendan.
Thanks, everybody.
Coming on Sunday, and talk to you soon. Bye.
Okay, bye.